Alpha 1-9er, commence Wi-Fi device checklist.
Laptops, on. TVs, streaming. Game console, consoling. Smart thermostat, set for cuddle time. Doorbell camera, oh, my package is here.
Fast, reliable, able to power tons of devices inside your home at once.
All systems go, you are clear for takeoff.
This is Xfinity Internet, Wi-Fi built to wow. And watch the short film, The Aviators, now playing at Xfinity.com. Restrictions apply, actual speeds vary and are not guaranteed.
Good evening from Washington. I'm Michael Steele and from my friend Jen Psaki. Jen is wrapping up a well-deserved vacation and we'll be back with you next week. We have a lot to cover tonight, so just settle in, right? But I do want to begin with a headline. Trump employs images of violence as political fuel for re-election fight. Now, you might be thinking, yeah, I saw this over the weekend. After all, Donald Trump posted a video on his social media site depicting President Biden with his hands and feet tied up in the back of a pickup truck. And at the same time, on that same site, Trump not only lashed out at the judge presiding over his New York criminal trial, but also at the judge's daughter. So, yeah, I'd say he's employing images of violence in his reelection fight right now. But folks, that headline is not from over the weekend. It is from September of 2020, almost four full years ago. And the fact that it very well could have been published today should serve as a stark reminder that Donald Trump has always been this guy. He's always been the guy who glorifies political violence, who embraces it to rev up his base. He's always been the guy who operates outside the typical norms in politics and business and law, who stresses, bends, and twists those systems into pretzels any chance he gets. And he's always been the guy who breaches protocol more times than he's abided by it. But just because he's done all these things before doesn't mean we should normalize it or even be numb to it. And Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg sure isn't becoming numb to it. No, he's not. Because late today, District Attorney Bragg once again urged the court to push back on Trump's behavior. He wants the judge in the criminal hush money case to expand the gag order to also protect family members of trial participants. He writes that Trump's dangerous, violent, and reprehensible rhetoric fundamentally threatens the integrity of these proceedings and is intended to intimidate witnesses and trial participants alike. And he points out that there is no constitutional right to target the family of this court. Defendant knows what he is doing, and everyone else does, too. And we all know that's very true, because we've seen it with our own eyes. Trump has brought violence to our politics, and he's brought disorder to our legal system. He has turned every courtroom he enters, and there have been many, into a circus, using hallways like a soapbox to spew outrageous and inflammatory lies. He is, in effect, putting his trials on trial. He's intimidated witnesses, violated gag orders, and has relentlessly attacked anyone holding him accountable, including, again, Judge Juan Merchan and his daughter, who is a private citizen. At the end of the day, we know everything we need to know about Donald Trump. We know who he is. And yet, despite all his bad behavior, these judges are still giving him the benefit of the doubt as if he were an ordinary defendant. No one else could ever get away with the crap that Donald Trump gets away with. He's acting like a visceral animal in politics, business, and law. That is the constant. That is the one thing we know. That is not changing. So enough is enough. The system now needs to adapt to the thing in front of it before it is consumed by that very thing. And on that point, we have some breaking news. Judge Merchan has just sided with District Attorney Bragg in a ruling minutes ago. He expanded the gag order to include family members of the court and of the DA's office. Joining me now here at the table is Mary McCourt. She is the former acting assistant attorney general for national security at the Justice Department. Also with us is former federal prosecutor and my buddy Glenn Kirshner. So, Glenn, let me start with you. The DA has just come back with this ruling moments ago. Tell us, I know he's been scouring over the paper here. Tell us what you find in this. What should we need to know about what the judge has done?
So, Michael, I would say predictably, Judge Juan Merchan expanded the gag order to include family members of the judge, of the court staff, of the prosecutor's office. That's wonderful. Donald Trump is laboring under, you know, a hat trick of shut up, mm-hmm. because there are three gag orders that have been in place over time. Judge Chutkan in the D.C. federal prosecution, Judge Engoron in the New York civil fraud trial, and now Judge Merchan in the New York, I don't call it a hush money case. Mm-hmm. It's the 2016 election interference case that includes hush money payments that were then covered up with false business records. Has it done any good? Has it helped? You just said a minute ago, Donald Trump is putting his trial on trials. He's putting the criminal justice system to the test. And I think the system is failing. And the reason I say that is because you just read in part the first sentence from the motion that was filed by District Attorney Bragg. And it reads, defendant's dangerous, violent, and reprehensible rhetoric fundamentally threatens the integrity of these proceedings and is intended to intimidate witnesses and trial participants alike, including this court. To this old prosecutor, the only sentence that makes sense coming after that assertion is, therefore, the people are moving for pretrial detention. I'm not saying, listen, we have four criminal cases across four jurisdictions. There are different rules in every jurisdiction. But the fact that no judge and no prosecutor has stepped up to actually put a stop to Trump's dangerous rhetoric is a real problem.
And Mary, that's where Glenn put his finger on the pulse of what really irritates the heck out of me about all of this, because that sentence should follow the beginning of that. What's your take on the judge's expansion of this gag order? And how do you see other judges in other trials that are before, that Trump is before, sort of assessing and dealing with this ruling?
I think the reason he expanded the gag order was less about his daughter and more about the message that Trump gets if he doesn't expand it, right? And that more about the message that potential jurors get if he doesn't expand it. I think he is now very worried, and this is something that the DA raised in their papers, very worried that people are going to be extremely reluctant to serve as jurors, to have any witnesses are going to start to, you know, become reluctant and maybe even be nervous about telling the truth on the stand because they feel like they're targeted, jurors, witnesses, trial participants, as well as their families. So to me, this was the judge saying, look, I've got to take this step here to send a message that the administration of justice will not be impinged mm-hmm. by this conduct of Donald Trump. And he also says, we're not in a David and Goliath situation here where the government is all powerful, because Trump himself, you know, has a bully pulpit about as substantial as any.
Right. So let's pick up on that bully pulpit idea, because what Donald Trump's lawyers have argued is that he has the constitutional protection of free speech to say these things, to go after Merchan's daughter. How does that factor into this particular ruling? And is that an element that really prevents what Glenn says should happen next from happening? Yeah.
Well, there's no question that defendants have First Amendment rights, but those rights can be constrained when you are in a courtroom facing a trial in a criminal case and in a civil case. And the Supreme Court's been very clear about that. That is the obligation of the judge to, you know, ensure that the defendant's behavior won't impact the administration of justice. And that could be through things like gag orders. It's through other restraints too, right? Because the point is you have to ensure that the defendant gets a fair trial, but that also means the public and the government get a fair trial as well. Right. It works both ways. And I think one of the things that Glenn has pointed out and that we've talked about, you know, in other shows is that the judges, even when they've issued these gag orders, Judge Chutkan, Judge Merchan, Judge Engoron, well, that was a civil case, so that was different. But in the two criminal cases, they did not actually make those part of the conditions of release and required Mr. Trump to sign that he mm-hmm. understands his conditions have now been expanded. And if he violates them, his release can be revoked. Instead, the remedies here are things like contempt of court for violating court order. Now, that can result in time in jail. So it's not toothless, but it's I think for those of us, former prosecutors, it's unusual that these restrictions on speech were not just incorporated into the conditions of release.
So Glenn, Donald Trump will violate this gag order in 3, 2, 1. I mean, so when that happens, what happens? I mean, because Mary points out that you don't have, you know, the defendant sort of signing, saying, OK, yeah, I acknowledge all this and this can happen to me. How do you see this playing out when that happens? Because you know it will.
Financial fines. And of course, who cares? Right. There were some minor financial fines put in place by Judge Engoron in the civil case when he violated the gag order. I agree with Mary. I mean, in theory, you can be held in contempt. You can be confined for a brief period of time. But I go back to the fundamentals of the law. The law ordinarily says when you're a defendant on pretrial release, particularly in serious felony cases, and Donald Trump has 4 serious felony cases, if there's clear and convincing evidence that you pose a danger to the community or even one person in the community, you can be detained pending trial to neutralize that threat.
Can I just push on that point? You pose a danger to the community. People, when they hear that, they're thinking, oh, you know, this guy's a violent actor. He's someone who has harmed someone and is now being prosecuted. This is, in one sense, a situation where there's no physical harm. It's just Donald Trump running his mouth and saying crazy stuff that may or may not result with some idiot out there picking up, you know, some action. How does that get squared by the court in a situation like this where that language, at least intuitively to someone who's, you know, listening to it from outside of the system, would hear, well, that would refer to someone who's raped somebody or shot somebody or done some physical harm to someone.
Yeah. So let me rely on what one of the appellate court judges said not 2 blocks from here during the gag order argument to the D.C. Federal Circuit Court of Appeals when Donald Trump's lawyer made that point. Wait a minute. He's not responsible for what his supporters do after he posts something. And the judge said, wait a minute. There is a clear pattern here. Donald Trump posts the name of a witness and threats ensue. He knows this. He can't disavow it. It's what he intends by posting the names and photos. Not to mention, he was seen holding a baseball bat mid-swing at the prosecutor's head. So let's not say, well, these aren't crimes of violence. Donald Trump is all about violence. He's just using his words to accomplish his ends.
And so, Mary, what does that mean for average, Joe and Jane out there who is a potential juror in one of these trials? And they're seeing this, they're hearing this, and I really get what Glenn is saying about the judge sort of anticipating that and say, all right, everything's off limits now. Family, court clerks, all of that. Does that really give some solace to a potential jury pool? or should I put something else in my coffee?
That's what Judge Mershon is trying to do. And the end of his order tonight warns the defendant. The defendant is hereby warned that any violation of this order will result in sanctions under, and he cites the law, which is the contempt sanctions. What he's trying to do is send in a message is, I do take this seriously. Don't be worried, Joe and Jane, potential jurors, because we will take action. But, you know, I don't know if that's good enough, because we'll see what Donald Trump does. And, you know, to your point in the opening about violence and to Glenn's point, I think what we are on right now, too, is just a slow or not so slow development of, you know, a long range incitement to violence. Right. Because we have the photos of President Biden in the, hogtied and kidnapped in the back of a truck. We have these incendiary, violent remarks about witnesses and prosecutors and judges. And this is all about inuring, you know, getting his base ready to take action. And, you know, unfortunately, our law, you know, doesn't protect incitement to imminent violence, but that violence, he wants it to come. That's why he's doing it. And I think there's a high likelihood it will come. And imminence is really hard to judge with a man like Donald Trump.
All right. Mary McCord, Glenn Kirshner, thank you guys very, very much for being here at the moment it all pops. Really appreciate it. Coming up, more breaking news. Donald Trump has just posted his bond in his New York civil fraud case. Tristan Snell is standing by. He's a former assistant attorney general in New York. and he joins me in about 60 seconds.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.
We've got more breaking news to bring you this Monday evening. Donald Trump has posted a bond in the amount of $175,000 in the civil fraud case in New York that he's planning to appeal. It was provided by the California-based company Knight Insurance. Joining me now is Tristan Snell. He's the former assistant attorney general for New York, who led the office's investigation into Trump University. He also is the author of the book Taking Down Trump, 12 Rules for Prosecuting Donald Trump, by someone who did it successfully. Tristan, thank you very much for joining us. I know you're just pouring through the filing, but what stands out to you and what are you finding?
Well, first off, I'm still trying to get information, just as you are. I really, really hope that that's $175 million and not $175,000.
Yeah, right. It's right.
$175 million was already, in my view, way too low. I think the appeals court botched this badly by allowing him to get off the hook, letting him, be able to post much less and give him more time to do it. As I've said, I think it's akin to taking a team that was going to lose a basketball game by 40 points and giving them 5 more minutes to play and lowering the hoop from 10 feet down to 6. It shouldn't have happened, and now we see where it gets us.
So just to clarify for everybody, it is $175 million. So where does this take us now in this appeals process? What does it look like? What should we be expecting?
Yeah, look, there was always a chance in this situation that the court would lower the amount that Trump would have to pay. There is also a chance that they could vacate or overturn the judgment entirely. I think the odds of that are lower. I think there is an absolute mountain of evidence supporting the finding of fraud in this case. It is possible, and I would say now it looks likely, that the appeals court will lower that award down from $464 million down to something that I still hope is going to be north of $175 million. We have to remember something here, Michael. Every dollar that Trump is being asked to pay now is a dollar he shouldn't have been lent to begin with, mm-hmm. and would not have been lent were it not for all of his lies.
How does this play out with other folks out there in the financial markets or looking at this whole process, given that there are other scenarios in which Trump could be held liable? How does this $175 million bond, when the judgment was $454 million, get reconciled? What is the rest of this story with respect to the difference between what was awarded and versus what he has to put up for a bond?
Yeah, look, I think anybody who's looking to lend Trump money or underwrite anything for him right now has got to be looking at this and saying, look, what next? It's not a great situation for him overall. And if you have other different loans outstanding with him, how well is he going to be able to actually repay these? I think that ultimately he's not going to win this appeal. He might get it lowered, but I don't think he's going to win it. I don't think he's going to win the appeal against E. Jean Carroll. I don't think that's happening. Again, that could get lowered a bit. I don't think it's going to get lowered all the way to zero or anywhere close. So, if you lent money to Donald Trump, and especially given his track record, I think that might not have been the best idea.
Put that money to some other uses. So like all things with Donald Trump, how long do you think this is going to take? Is there something that, you know, we should be looking at being dragged out, or is this something that could get turned around pretty quickly?
Yeah. Donald Trump's biggest weapon when he's trying to evade justice, and I talk about this a ton in my book, is delay. Ultimately, a lot of the things that he does, what are all these distractions, the clown car full of lawyers? What is he trying to do here? He's just trying to throw sand into the gears of justice, try to actually stop it from happening. And then he hopes that this is going to cause other things to break his way. And in the context of the election, he's hoping that it's going to allow him somehow to win and then be able to wave some sort of magic kingly wand and, you know, monarch or dictator his way out of all of this. So I think he is going to try to delay these appeals for as long as he can. But critically, I think the AG's office should be trying to seek expedited review of this case, because Donald Trump has already been moving money around. He moved $40 million out of the Trump Organization to pay private legal costs that he had, a tax bill, plus some of the money that he owes to E. Jean Carroll. And he did that against a court order, in violation and basically in secret, away from the eyes of the court-ordered monitor. So there's already a clear track record here that Donald Trump is the financial equivalent of a flight risk. He is going to try to make this money disappear. And as a result, the AG's office should say, we need to move faster before all of this money is gone and the right of the people to this money is frustrated. Justice is frustrated.
So Tristan, on that point, because he is a financial flight risk in that regard, but he does have these assets out there that we also have talked about over the last couple of weeks. Where does that money come from? What is the collateral, do you think, that's behind this $175 million bond? Because I'm sure, you know, the folks who posted it got to attach it to something. So what does that look like?
Look, there have been a lot of reports that underwriters did not want to use his properties as collateral. We don't know exactly how this is working. It could be the properties. It could be revenue streams from the properties. It could be cash that he has on hand. My understanding is that he's not allowed to do anything that commits the stock that he has in this new Truth Social public company SPAC. That would actually be against his lockup. He's not allowed to actually get rid of any of that stock for 6 months. And I don't believe that he's allowed to have anything use that as collateral either. It's possible that some other folks who understand that wing of the Trump legal saga would be able to weigh in differently on that. But my understanding is that he cannot encumber that stock. So some combination of all of those things, we don't know. It's a mystery as to really why anybody would, given the human wreckage that he has created with all of the vendors and business partners that he screwed over, the people that he ruined by going into bankruptcy as well, you'd think that people would think twice before lending him or underwriting him a nickel. But there you go.
Well, as in all things, Tristan, follow the money, right? That's what you need to do in this situation. Tristan Snell, thank you so much, my friend, for being on with us tonight. Coming up, new comments from Trump's former defense secretary, Mark Esper, could be indicative of a broader trend in the Republican Party and one that the Biden campaign actually can take advantage of. President Obama's former campaign manager and David Plouffe is here to break it all down for us, and he joins me next. We'll be right back.
I've said I believe he's a threat to democracy, and we should be very mindful of that.
So you'll vote for Biden?
Well, you know, with every... I'm not there yet. I'm definitely not voting for Trump, but I'm not there yet.
This you'll have to explain to me, sir. I respect you so much. Thank you for your service. I mean that so sincerely. But I just don't understand smart people who don't get binary.
I understand. Look, you also have the option.
How can you not be there after what you just said?
There's no way I will vote for Trump. But every day that Trump does something crazy, the door to voting for Biden opens a little bit more. And that's where I am.
I think that's a slow opening door.
Okay, can we talk? You know it's bad when your own defense secretary says he's definitely not voting for you. And Mark Esper is definitely not voting for Trump, and he's not alone. In fact, a new political analysis of this year's primary results show that Donald Trump's weakness with Republican voters goes beyond the highly educated suburban areas that have swung blue over the past decade. They found that there's also a significant block of voters who did not want Trump in more ex-urban, red-leaning counties, making it clear that while independents and crossover voters may have boosted Nikki Haley in some primaries, a chunk of true Republican voters still wish for someone else to be the party's nominee. But as Politico also notes, skepticism of Trump doesn't mean Biden has an easy road. So the big question for the president is if he can turn anti-Trump voters into pro-Biden voters. David Plouffe was the campaign manager for Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. He also served as a senior advisor to President Obama, and he joins me now. David, it's so good to see you as always. So just how deep...
Great to see you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. How deep is this Republican break from Trump in your eyes? How do you see it? Is it real? And is it something that Biden can take advantage of?
Well, Michael, I would say it's deep enough. You know, this is going to be a very close race.
That's honest. So I like that. That's good.
And I think it's bigger than we had in 20 and bigger than we had in 16. I mean, back in 16, you know, you and I probably knew most of the Republicans who were opposed to Trump, right? We thought there were more than there were. There's a lot more now. And the way I think about it, let's look at Wisconsin. Biden won that state narrowly by about 20,000 votes with about 1,630,000 votes. Let's say there's more third party vote share this time. So maybe you need 1.6 million. Biden's probably guaranteed of like 1.48 million, 1.5 million. How do you find the rest? Well, some of that will be young people that aren't sure they're going to vote. Some of that will be, you know, true independent. But there's going to be a big chunk that are Republicans. And so in the six or seven states that determine the presidency, there clearly is a bigger swath of target voters than were available to Biden when he won in 20 or in 16. So that could not be a bigger deal. It's not all of the votes you need to win a battleground state, but it's a pretty important piece of the pie. And the great thing is there's a lot of Republicans like Esper and others who can be the messengers, whether they, you know, volunteer to do so directly or indirectly, that are much more powerful than like the Biden campaign asking for their vote. So that's important. I think there's enough target voters out there, and I think there's a both good message and messengers to reach those voters.
But David, here's the rub as I see it in some respects. Do you think the Democrats underestimate the Republicans' ability to basically hold their nose and vote for Trump? You hear the narratives out there that Republicans do come home, and they do. They do have a tendency to come home because for them, it's not so much voting for Donald Trump as it is voting for the party. So how do you see cracking that particular part of the shell to break through? And in the process of doing that, is there a tendency or maybe even a sort of a troubling narrative that you may just overestimate the number of Republicans that you can actually pick up?
Well, this can seem very nerdy and boring, but politics is about candidates and message and timing. But as you know, it's about math. And a good campaign knows exactly how many votes they need to win a state, and they know where those are going to come from. So if the Biden campaign were to overestimate the number of Republicans they can get, that would be a problem. I don't think they will. And yes, almost all Republicans who didn't vote in the primaries, let's say, are going to come home to Trump. Most of the Haley voters will come home to Trump. Mm-hmm. But you've got a pool of voters out there, very sophisticated data and modeling and research. You can understand who's coming home, no matter how they voted in the primary, and who's actually open either to not voting, as Esper kind of fumbled around about, but ultimately voting for Biden. And so I think you just have to look at it as how do you get to a win number in these battleground states? And I think that it's a small piece of the pie, but it's an important piece of the pie, particularly when I think Biden is going to have all the challenges in the world of maximizing his both vote share and turnout amongst young people. So in a way, if he can do slightly better with Republicans than he did in 20, it might help mitigate a little bit of leakage with young voters.
I have to say, David, you're one of the few political guys, professionals that I talk to that when I walk away from asking questions like the ones I just did, that I actually go, OK, he gets it. So I do appreciate that. Here's the other side, though. Trump likes to turn his legal troubles into politics. So let's do that. Let's turn them into politics, because just in the last half hour, he had a gag order expanded against him and had to post a $175 million bond. So in this new environment, how do Democrats use this kind of thing, this kind of issue about the vulnerabilities legally that Trump has politically?
Well, I think that I don't want to overstate this, but I think most American voters are seeing something about Trump's legal problems. And I think for those Republicans we just talked about and independents who don't want to return to 4 years of narcissism and corruption and circus, it's helpful. I do think Democratic voices probably need to do a better job of explaining what these are, because Trump and his allies are trying to say, we're a victim. This is Biden's DOJ. You know, these are shady business practices. No other business in America can get away with. You know, this is for paying off a porn star he was having an affair with. He's been credibly accused of rape. So I think you have to remind people, you know, it's just like when we talk about the fight for democracy, you can't shorthand it. You got to explain what that means, why that would be harmful to the country. I think you have to do the same thing on these cases. I think it will rally, you know, his base, you know, to the extent that he's seen as a victim. But we see he's having real difficulty raising money, in part because he's, you know, diverting it to his legal case. And, you know, turnout in the Republican primaries has not been what you might think if people were super enthused about him. So, again, I think it will help him rally the core MAGA, which is about 25% of the country. But I think for everybody else, it's just another kind of brick on the wagon. Like, how many more bricks can the wagon take, right? We don't want to. And at the end of the day, that's how I see this election. It's, are there enough people out there who are either thinking about not voting or truly deciding between Biden and Trump or Biden and third party, who just say, I can't do another 4 years of this, right? And then it's the Biden campaign's job to convert those people. And some piece of them are the Republicans we talked about in the beginning of the show.
All right, Democrats, get them bricks. Put the bricks on the wagon. Break that sucker down. All right, David Plouffe, we appreciate you, man. Thank you so much. Up next, somehow a devastating and deadly bridge collapse has become political for some members of my party. I'll explain why when we come back.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
The White House announced today that President Biden will travel to Baltimore on Friday to visit the site of the Key Bridge collapse. That comes after the president called on Congress to put up the money needed to not only clean up the disaster, but to rebuild the bridge itself. And let's just say the response from some in my party, well, it's been less than enthusiastic.
It was kind of outrageous immediately for Biden to express in this tragedy the idea that he's going to use federal funds to pay for it in entirety. I mean, you know, he doesn't refer to it as the American taxpayer dollars on anything. You know, the first reaction, in fact, the only reaction, just tends to be to spend.
It's outrageous, says Congressman Dan Muser. But not to be outdone, Congresswoman Nancy Mace blamed the bridge collapse on the Green New Deal. And Congressman Derek Van Orden claimed that Biden is just trying to pander to wealthy shipping companies and insurance agencies. Yeah, let's look at the fact. And the fact is, Congress should act quickly to handle one of the worst bridge collapses in the country's history, much as they did in 2007 after a deadly bridge collapse in Minnesota. But to hear some of these Republicans in Congress talk about the tragedy in Baltimore, well, it's almost as if it shouldn't matter to the country at all. And I can't say I'm surprised, given what Donald Trump has said about Baltimore in the past. He's called the city the worst in the nation, a disgusting rat and rodent infested mess where no human being would want to live, where residents are living in hell. And folks, if you remember, those comments were directed at the late Elijah Cummings, the former congressman who represented Baltimore's 7th Congressional District for over 20 years. So while it is notable that Donald Trump has been silent about this tragedy, well, guess what? It's just not surprising. In fact, I'd say it was expected. He has yet to offer any condolences or express any sympathy for the victims. He's not issued a statement even acknowledging the basic facts of what happened. And as someone who likes to boast about being a real estate mogul, calling himself a builder, well, you would think Trump would jump at the opportunity to talk about it. Or maybe even, heck, just blame the accident on Joe Biden. But even his campaign wouldn't respond to Politico's request for comment. So look, Trump's silence about this tragedy in Baltimore says a whole lot about his unique contempt for the city and its residents. It's clearly trickling down to his allies in Congress. And if he returns to the White House, it's hard to see him helping Baltimore and its recovery in the wake of this tragedy. But we can certainly see him renaming the bridge after himself. We'll be back after a quick break. Stay with us. Well, it's official. Abortion access will be on the ballot in Florida this fall. The state Supreme Court issued a ruling a few hours ago approving a ballot measure that, if passed, would guarantee Floridians the right to abortion before viability, which is about 24 weeks. However, as with all state rulings, it can't be that straightforward. The state Supreme Court also upheld Florida's 15-week limit on abortion today, which triggers a more restrictive 6-week limit that will go into effect within 30 days. So in other words, Floridians will face a 6-week abortion ban in their state until November, when voters will get to decide whether to enshrine protections for up to 24 weeks. Joining me now is Florida State Representative Anna Escamani. She worked with Planned Parenthood in Florida for a number of years before getting into politics. Representative, thank you so much for joining us. I'm assuming you see today as a victory for advocates of reproductive rights. Do you expect this ballot measure to pass in your state in November? How does it feel on the ground right now?
Well, I have to tell you, the energy is incredible. People are motivated now that we know we have abortion on the ballot this November. But of course, the 6-week abortion ban is going to be devastating. In 30 days, Florida will have a near total abortion ban impacting our residents, but also women in the South who come to Florida for access to care. The closest option for us will likely be Virginia. And so we're going to have to navigate the on-the-ground crisis for reproductive care, while also, of course, staying focused on victory in November.
Wow, that's a powerful statement that the closest access will likely be Virginia. So then this broadens out a little bit. Because you have this big Senate race in your state with Rick Scott running for re-election, and then, of course, the presidential race between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, how much does this decision change the political landscape ahead of November in terms of not just the narratives, but how voters are going to look at these campaigns?
Well, I think what's so unique about abortion access, Michael, is that regardless of political affiliation, we all know someone who's had an abortion. And I've seen so many Republican women in my own state, but of course across the country, sit up and say that their party has gone too far, that these bans are extreme, and they are supporting codification. They are supporting rejecting political interference into our personal lives. And so I can't speak to, you know, what this will mean for some of these top of ticket races. What I can say is that we need to secure 50% on candidates, but 60% when it comes to ballot initiatives. So in order to win, it needs to be a broad coalition of folks of every political identity and background.
Well, and to that point, the Biden campaign told NBC News this evening that it believes it has a shot to win Florida, and that abortion will be a key factor in helping make inroads in the state. So in that regard, is Florida winnable, both at the Senate level as well as the federal level with the presidency?
As someone born and raised in Florida, I am proud to say that Florida is always worth fighting for.
There you go.
We need all boots on the ground. We need folks registered to vote and ready to ensure that we not only codify reproductive rights, but we help ensure that we have elected officials that reflect those same values.
You know, it's interesting because the group that was leading this effort to get abortion on the ballot this November collected well over 910,000 validated signatures of registered voters in Florida. At least 150,000 of those signatures came from registered Republicans. And something, Representative, I've been saying for a while, which you as a Floridian, native Floridian, knows to be true. Republicans also are very much aligned with the effort to keep abortions as an access opportunity, a healthcare issue for a lot of Republican women. How does that change the political dynamic, do you think?
Well, that is so well said. Again, when you need access to reproductive rights, when you walk into a clinic, nobody's asking for your party ID. And so I do think that regardless of whether you decide to become a parent, choose adoption, or end a pregnancy, that decision is between you, your family, your doctor, your faith, and not politicians. And that belief transcends political lines. I'm very, very hopeful that we'll see those 150,000 Republicans I signed on, we'll see that number grow and folks who support this ballot initiative come November.
All right. Florida Representative Anna Eskamani, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. We'll be back, folks, right after a quick break. Stay with us. Well, that does it for me tonight. Jen Psaki will be back from vacation for next week's shows. And be sure to join me, Alicia Menendez, and Simone Sanders Towson every Saturday and Sunday from 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern on The Weekend on MSNBC.
Alpha 1-9er, commence Wi-Fi device checklist.
Laptops on. TVs streaming. Game console consoling. Smart thermostat set for cuddle time. Doorbell camera. Oh, my package is here.
Fast, reliable, able to power tons of devices inside your home at once.
All systems go, you are clear for takeoff.
This is Xfinity Internet, Wi-Fi built to wow. And watch the short film, The Aviators, now playing at Xfinity.com. Restrictions apply. Actual speeds vary and are not guaranteed.